He is correct. It is a wordy title. My name is Ray Wright. I work for the University of Missouri Columbia out at Bradford Research Extension Center. A little bit ago, we heard presentations on biofuels and turning them into using for a liquid fuel. We are focusing a little bit differently out at Bradford, and we're looking at diversity, too. Everything I've heard so far has been looking at basically monocultures. So, with that, we'll get started with the presentation. Can highly diverse native plant systems provide sufficient biomass for biofuel production, wildlife habitat, and quality forage? All right. This is the layout of the presentation I'll be giving today. We'll talk a little bit about the premise, some definitions for our study, a little bit on plot, and then a conclusion. Probably the main reason why most people out here are working with biofuels is because of this. In 2007, there's a government mandate, an act of Congress, to put funds towards research of biofuels. 36 billion gallons of biofuel by 2022. Of that, 15 billion will come out of corn, 6 billion can come out from soybeans, and the other 15 billion is going to be coming from the cellulosic biostocks. One of the things when this was coming into play, we had been talking about it, setting up a study like this, because there's a lot of concerns with it. And one of the studies we looked at before was by Tillman. I believe he's out of Minnesota. And it was basically looking at diverse stands of grasses versus monocultures and looking at the yield and carbon sequestration. So that kind of got us thinking. Well, when we started this study, we laid out some definitions, and for our biofuel production, we wanted to use tonnage to represent that. Quality wildlife habitat was diversity. In general, anytime you look at wildlife habitat, diversity is the answer. The more diverse it is, the better wildlife habitat it's going to be. And then we wanted to look at forage quality, and we used relative feed value for that one. In Missouri, we have chipping mills and pelletizing plants that are up and coming. Some of them are quite established. And we wanted to kind of focus our attention towards that instead of the liquid-based fuel. Mainly, there's a few reasons, but one is it's something that can be developed in a local farming community. It's in our hands. This pellet you see right over here, that was, and the feedstock came off our farm. We developed a pelletizing machine right there on the farm. Now that pellet can then be used for municipal or for blending with coal fire systems, as our last speaker had mentioned, to meet some standards on renewable resources if they fit through the grate size. And then also we can use them for pelletizing or for heating homes, schools, and boilers. So that keeps it kind of on a local level. Now there's other systems out there, the gasification. One thing about that is it takes quite a bit of energy. It can use multiple feedstocks, but it uses quite a bit of energy. And then the fermentation process. This it has a couple drawbacks. It's in play with the ethanol, but you have to have specific enzymes for a specific feedstock. That would lean towards the monocultures, and that's kind of one of the things we wanted to step away from. All right, for wildlife habitat, as I stated earlier, quality wildlife is represented by diversity. Now, this picture over here, it really says a lot. If you can look in the background, you see the farmer's fields out there. And then as you look closer, you start seeing the diverse flora and fauna. And it also adds something that I really never thought about and should think about more, is the soil as part of the system. So that picture, not only because my boss likes it, it does say basically what we're looking at here. The picture to the side is a bobwhite quail. In Missouri, quail populations have been going down rather steadily. One of the reasons is habitat loss. If you can look at quails walking down the road, either side of it is pure stands of fescue. Quail can't get through fescue. They can't push through the dense stands. He's heading over to the tree line, and the reason he's going up to the tree line is because there he can find some diversity. Unfortunately, we have so many birds of prey out there, I bet that critter never made it. Forage quality. We use the I'm not a forage man, but I talked with some of them, and the relative feed value is the value we decided to use. And I'll explain why that's important here in a little bit. But the relative feed value basically takes your samples that you send out for analyzation, takes several parameters and clumps them into a nice, neat little number. So that's why we use that one. This will take me just a little bit to go through this, and I hope I don't lose you guys on this. We started putting together our plot plan. How are we going to study all these things? I am going to, for the purpose of this talk, focus on this section of the study. The only difference on these studies is this one over here, when we say monoculture, it has a big blue stem switchgrass monoculture. Basically, the monoculture is it's just pure grass stands, but two different species. What I want to focus on for this talk is over here on this side, which is true monoculture switchgrass. We designed a study where we looked at 100% switchgrass. We looked at 40% legume and forbs, 60% switchgrass, 60% legume and forbs and switchgrass, 40% switchgrass, and then 80% legumes and forbs with 20% switchgrass. Now, the reason the legumes are so important in this study is they basically benefit each one of the components. For biofuel production, if we're looking at tonnage, the legume fixes atmospheric nitrogen, can incorporate it back into soil, and therefore help maintain or beef up the yields on biofuel. For forage, cattle will select the legumes. It's a very nutritious plant, and it's good for livestock forage. And then for wildlife, we'll take quail again. They need to eat a certain amount of energy every day to just stay alive. And a legume seed is packed with energy. So that legume component is pretty important to this study. I have a 6-inch cut, a 12-inch cut. And the main reason we wanted to do that 12-inch cut is to basically maintain the legume component of the plots. The theory behind that was if you cut 6 inches every time, you're going to end up creating a monoculture. One species is going to outcompete the rest. But if we break it up to 12 inches, we wanted to see what the species composition of the plots are. Not that that's very practical in the haying world. Okay, the harvest times. We'll harvest these plots in one time a year, a March harvest, a July harvest, and an October harvest. The March harvest is to represent for biofuel. At that time, all the mobile nutrients can go down in the soil. The leaves are on the ground, and you have a lot of stemmy product. I can tell you there's nothing enjoyable about harvesting in March with haying equipment. It's very rough, but we wanted to have that representation. In July, that harvest is to represent our forage quality because you have a lot more nutrients coming up through the plants as they're growing. And then in October, that was designed for wildlife, for quail in particular, because if you're not harvesting that field off during the summer, during the nesting season, it gives them a chance to to reproduce. But it also works well with biofuel and also for livestock grazing. Not as good as the July. All right, there's a lot to see on this graph. And this is that one side of the plot. This is my 6-inch cut, and this is my 12-inch cut. We're going to focus on the 6-inch cut. There's our different monthly cuts. First thing I want to point out is this bar right here is the 100% grass on every one of them. And the ratios of forb to legumes are here. And they are, as I stated them earlier. But the important thing to look at here is this was about 3.75 tons per acre on the switchgrass. My forbs and legumes were a little over 3.25, 2.99, and 3, I believe, on those values. So they're very close. I ran the stats on them, and there's no significant difference between those forbs and legumes and the switchgrass, which is a good thing. That tells me that if a monoculture is producing the same amount, why not use another system that can benefit the other components? You look at October harvest, the tonnage drops down, leaves are starting to fall off, plants are going into dormancy, and once again our forbs and legumes are maintaining themselves. March, there's a little bit of disturbance in that data. That's probably due to me and mud, so But similar results, except the switchgrass was laying flat and you just couldn't quite pick that up as easy. Now, what happened in July 2011? Well, one thing, we decided to start adding fertilizer to the system. And we did just on the 100% switchgrass. And that shot our yields up to 4.25. But look at the forbs and legumes. They also came up. Well, what I believe happened there is Alabama just said it took 3 years for establishment. Is that correct? 3 years for establishment. We're a little bit colder, a little bit more variable on temperatures. And I think what we're looking at is this was our three-year establishment right here. But our fourth year, I think the plots became more fulfilled. And I would assume that from here on out, that's going to be our tonnage that we're going to look at. This is the big blue stem switchgrass. I don't really want to spend a lot of time on it, but I would like to say, and I look at the switchgrass big blue component. Look how it's fallen down in not only tonnage, but in comparing to the others. I've seen this before in some of my native warm season stands where I have big blue stem and switchgrass mixes. They tend to compete against each other. And I believe what's going on here is since the competition's going on in that monoculture stage, that they're really not being able to express themselves. I have a feeling if we were to pull one or the other out and just have a pure stand of big blue or switchgrass, you'd see a lot higher yields. But I just wanted to point that out. Now, we've talked a bit about quail. We do a lot of work with quail out at Bradford Farms, so we wanted to kind of look at something different. The rodents are the bottom of the food chain. So we decided to do some trapping in these plots. 2009, we set out traps in every one of the plots, and we came up with one deer mouse. We did this at another location, and we had one deer mouse. This is as the plots were getting established. They really weren't much over a field at that time. We come back in 2011, I believe there's 48. So once again, as these plots became established, became more diverse, we were able to have a more diversity in the food chain there. I was kind of hoping to see a pattern on where the voles wanted to be, if they were in the pure switchgrass versus the forbs and legumes. I haven't quite seen anything of that nature yet, but I'm going to keep looking. Harvest quality data. Like I said, I'm not a forage person, but when I speak with them about the relative feed value, they say you get around 68. That's the number you want. And it is all maintenance grade. All this is maintenance grade. But as far as that value of 68 goes, in October or in July, which is my forage quality cut, they're all up well above 68 as far as that number goes. In October, they're a little bit low. Once again, no significant difference between any of these plots. So as far as forage quality goes, that's a good thing as well. Now, why is that important? In Missouri, 2009. We were second in the nation in cow-calf operations. I believe we are a player in the cattle market. Well, where is this biofuel movement going to take place? It's probably not going to touch on our crop grounds. That food versus fuel, probably not going to happen. It's going to take place on our CRP-type grounds and our rangelands. That's going to start causing problems with the cattle farming. One of the biggest concerns I have is if we go through and say, hey, look, we've got a dedicated feed source of, say, miscanthus. You can put towards biofuel. A farmer comes in, takes out some of his grazing land, to put in this biofuel crop, and say the market isn't realized or coming too slow, you have that ground taken away with a crop that's essentially useless. And that's a big concern because this is an up-and-coming market. We don't know what's going to happen. If we were to look at using these diverse stands that I've showed, you can have them for grazing. You can graze them if you need them, if that's your decision. And just their own, just because they're in place, they would replace some of our CRP type grounds, and that would help wildlife. So I think that's a good thing. And in conclusion, diverse stands of native plants can provide sustainable biofuel product. Yes, compared to the ones we have. There are some critters out there that miscanthus really puts out a lot of tonnage, and it's hard to beat, can't beat that. But with the other components of it, using it for grazing or wildlife, that definitely can be a better choice. Diverse stands provide quality wildlife habitat. As I said earlier, anytime you have diversity, the more diversity is, the better wildlife habitat you're going to have. And then diverse stands provide forage, suitable forage for livestock grazing. Yes, they're right up there where we need them. And one of the things on the forage quality, I'm hearing a lot that the way they analyze them is not designed for our C4 type plants and our forbs. It's more geared towards alfalfa. So I believe there's some efforts to try to do a different type of analysis, because when they do rate of gain studies on native plants, the rate of gains are better than what they would predict with the relative feed values. With that, I'll take any questions. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ray.